I'm going to take a few questions for Eric. Excuse.
Last night, Eric, I thought one of the young kids offered a great question. Why hasn't abortion affected this birth rate?
Specifically related to the birth rate. It has. There's no doubt about it. 50 million people have been aborted in America since 1973. If they were to be around right now, there would actually be another generation, the result of their own progeny. So we're talking about potentially 100 million lives, maybe more, who would be citizens. But that's actually not the biggest factor related to the fertility rate in America. It's a factor, but not the main one. The main reason is hard to pin down. There are 1,000 little reasons, as the Jonathan Last quote said, ranging from the pill, which was just incredibly, incredibly influential in the way that it affected our view of sex and marriage and relationships. That there's no way that is going to go back into the can. It's out. It's just the reality that we're going to live with. There's another really fascinating example he discusses in his book, car seats. Who would think car seats as detrimental to the building of bigger families? Some of you may have little kids. Some of you may not have been around. You guys are shaking your heads. So you're going to know what I'm talking about here. You cannot, in most hospitals in America, you cannot leave until a nurse walks you to your car and makes sure that your car seat's been properly installed. Many places require you to actually take the car seat to a fire station where they'll check it out and ensure that everything is squared away that it's supposed to be. Car seats have an expiration date, and there are stories of people who've had their car seats confiscated at the fire station because they were past their expiration date. You go from car seat to booster seat for other kids as they get a little bit older, not allowed to sit in the front seat until they're so many pounds and so many age. All of this is kind of a nuisance, but in actuality, it's a tremendous disincentive to having larger families. Think about it. You have two kids. You drive a Honda Accord. You have two car seats. You think we should have a third kid. You can't fit three car seats in a Honda Accord. And now you're talking about getting a new van, right? And that's just one example of one of the thousands of ways that our society has lost its sense of the importance of families. I'm going to give you one more quote about car seats. I believe car seat laws, I'm going to get the data a little bit wrong here, I think they really started to come into being in like the early 90s, and they just spread like wildfire. Now they're everywhere. The statistics say that over the last 20 or 30 years, approximately 7,000 lives have been saved directly as a result of car seats. 7,000 lives. Now, every one of those lives is extremely valuable, and I'm sure that the families of those people who were saved from those lives are very thankful. But 7,000 for the cost and the time and the regulation and the disincentive to larger families that's resulted from these things is crazy. Just one example that I particularly found fascinating.
I'm going to get in trouble with my son-in-law who's sitting right over here. But I'm going to tell a story on him. Some of you married couples have had accidents. Wonderful accidents. Well, Anita and Chris had an accident with their child. And I'll never forget, Chris had a comment, something like this. Maybe I should let you say it, Chris, but they're not all going to fit in my car anymore. And boy, are we glad that idle guy is here. Wileen's got a question.
Well, my question is, you said something about the glorifying the promiscuity. What role do you think pornography plays in that whole thing? And my goodness, it's such a huge industry underground.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that. I think that the ramifications of a pornographic culture are widespread and incredibly destructive. I'll just give you one insight of my own. I'm a 29-year-old guy, grew up with the internet. You know, I think I've had it since I was in fourth grade or something. So my generation is the first that came through adolescence. Hormones are raging with the availability of pornography at a level that was just extreme. And the kind of pornography that you can find on the internet compared to when my dad was a kid and it was a couple of guys sneaking into the forest with a Playboy magazine or whatever, which is bad, but nothing like what you can find on the internet. I can say my own friends and the college students I work with, especially the men, are incredibly reluctant to get married. And in some instances, it's like they have no drive at all to get married. And I attribute that to one thing, sexual fulfillment in another realm. Very realistic sexual fulfillment, point of view sexual fulfillment, where they don't need to get married. Their desire for that is fully taken care of on their own. So that's just one way. And I think you could talk about violence against women. You know, I met with a woman who does research on this at Princeton, the same place where Robbie George works. And I don't know if you know that when they captured Osama bin Laden, they found a cache of porn. And she said this is not unusual with high-ranking terrorists, despite their supposed Islamic views and fundamentalism and all of that. They are all consuming all kinds of destructive, violent pornography. And look what they do with their lives. You can talk about rape. We can talk about all the other socialism in our country. And I think it's a direct result of the commoditization of women.
And the violence really ramps up when you go to cohabiting or other forms outside of marriage. I wanted to comment, too, that your comments about fertility rates, which is we could talk all day about fertility rates and get some of my friends up here. But Mr. Stone Street, one of his hammering points. Do you know what the fertility rate is amongst the Muslims? It's about 7, I think, isn't it, Alfred? Something like that.
Yeah. But you know what's interesting, and I'm sure that that's true and kind of scary to think about, the fertility rate's also high among evangelicals, which is good, and it's very high among Catholics, which is good. It could be higher. Go out and have more kids. And I'm speaking to the choir. I mentioned the rates for Hispanics, and this is something you hear a lot in the news today, is that the Hispanic population in America is growing, and they're going to take over. They're going to be the biggest percentage of our population before too long. We need to change. The rates are plummeting for Hispanics, and it's for one reason. They're becoming Americans, and the cultural factors that influence our fertility rates, white and black fertility rates, are influencing Hispanic fertility rates. So for one, it's not going to save us from total destruction, but two, it's also it's not going to have the consequences or the ramifications for policy that a lot of people think it will if they just look at the trend lines.
If you want to drill down on that, I'll make the point again. A nation of singles, and if we run out of those, he really drills into that area.
You're right, and it's the same author that I've gotten statistics from,
sure.
Jonathan Last. Yeah, it's really wonderful.
Other questions? Come on, you guys.
Unfortunately, because my brother-in-law passed away and my sister had Parkinson's, my husband and I ended up having her care the last 2 years of her life. And because of that, I know that there are alternate ways of taking care of someone. Mm-hmm. And that's the part I don't get. Is I actually heard about the story that you were talking about, the lesbian couple. I heard that on the radio, and I was just astounded, because the truth of the matter was it was poor planning on their part, and that's why it ended up being the way it was. Mm. But we already have things in existence, even for the two brothers.
Yeah.
We actually have things legally in existence that can help to make those provisions, mm-hmm. and truly there really is no reason to go any further, is my understanding from what I went through with my sister.
Yeah. That's true.
And that's what I don't get. It's like, we already have it. Why do we have to reinvent the wheel?
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. I'm not sure that we have everything in place that's needed for all of these situations, at least not in every state. And states are different. I know some states have reciprocal beneficiary agreements. There's obviously powers of attorney. I'm not an attorney. I can't get into all of this. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how that affects things like property taxes and trusts and all that. The talking point that you'll hear from advocates of same-sex marriage is that there are currently 1,000 instances where married couples have benefits that aren't available to same-sex partnerships. I'm sure that that's not true, given the nature of their argument, But I wouldn't be surprised if there are some instances where it is true. And there are probably some instances where it's going to stay true. Because, like, in the instance of adoption, kids need a mom and a dad, and we're going to put a we're going to die on that hill. But there may be instances where we can give a little ground. And my own personal view is that we can do a lot of healing. We can reach resolution on this issue if we are willing to compromise on the things that we can compromise on. And there are some things that we can't, but I think there are some things that we can.
Jeff had a comment in the back.
His question is women entering the workforce and fertility rates. Yeah, I do. I don't. The data bears that out plainly. I mean, it's absolutely part of it. And that's related to the statistics on socioeconomic status and education. I have a friend.
And tax rates.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember where I was. I can remember the field I was in 20 years ago in Iowa when Dr. Dobson was talking about how our tax rates were increasing and helping send mothers to jobs. Forgive the interruption.
No, yeah. I have a friend, Ben Domenich, who you should all know. He's a wonderful writer. He writes all over the place in blogs. He has something called The Transom. It's a morning email every single day he writes that you can subscribe to that gives an overview of everything that's happening in Washington with a lot of pith. He has this great quote. He says, "There was a war on women, fought by women, against women, and women lost." That's how he describes the women's rights movement in the last 40 years. It's a mess, and we want to affirm women who want to work, but there's no doubt that we have to recognize the implications that that has in other areas, because women are the only ones who can have kids. So big questions for our society. Yeah.
Other questions?
Has everyone looked at car seats and risks of ADHD down the road? Could you strap your kids in? That's more of a comment. And I have four kids, so I understand this issue. But my other question is the pro-gay lobby, are they ever going to be satisfied with anything other than full marriage? I mean, I think that there's issues there.
Yeah, great question. I'm really glad you asked that, because this gets at a fundamental way of looking at this issue. And I should build this into my speech, because it's really important. I gave the picture of the two boxers earlier today, and that's how our side views this argument, right? It's us against them. The gay rights advocacy movement does not view this that way. They don't care about our arguments. They don't respond to them. They don't listen to them. They don't care, and they're winning. And it's because they're making different arguments to different people. No one's trying to convince me that I'm wrong. They're trying to convince my sister, who lives in Kansas, of what they believe. We're in a beauty pageant, not a boxing match.
Say that again.
We're in a beauty pageant, not a boxing match. We don't have to beat the other side. What we have to do is win the hearts and minds of the population. So I think that that's a different way of looking at this that we should take to heart and stop allowing ourselves to get caught up in arguments with the other side and just make our own arguments to the persuadables that are out there.
Well, other than being educated, as you are doing to us, giving us information, and other than reading good books, whatever, and following the course of Jeff Laslaffy with, you know, legal, supporting legal things, what can we do? What path can we walk down? What can we do to assist, besides supporting the Manhattan Declaration?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, that's thanks for that. If you haven't seen this, pick it up.
Thank you, Tony.
And sign. I base my approach to the Manhattan Declaration on one principle. And it's that each and every one of you is an influencer. You have your sphere of influence, and I have mine. And you are much more important than I am. There are 534,228 people who've signed the Manhattan Declaration the last time I checked. Every one of them has the opportunity to influence their family, their friends in real life and online, their coworkers, people at church. You are all advocates of these ideas. My hope is to equip you all with really good information, ideas and talking points and ways of going about this so that you can be the boots on the ground making the difference. I'm less interested in political answers to these things and more interested in cultural ones. Politics is downstream from culture, and culture is nothing but you all. and what you do in your daily lives, that's culture. So we rely on you being willing to have a conversation with someone who disagrees with you and putting forth arguments in a respectful and loving way, and hopefully over time winning them over to our side. That's the most important thing you can do.
That's why we're doing what we're doing, and that's why our motto is equipping cultural influencers with a Christian worldview, so we can have intelligent conversations. Could I get you to?
I'm Richard, and a plug for Americans Godly Heritage is over there on the shelf there. They removed God from the schools in 1963, and it had, like you have, statistical analysis. With that happening, God has been removed from the schools, and it's affecting all these different statistics that you have there. And my question is that we are trying to battle that, and what do you think as far as what your movement does and in the schools, how can you, you know, be an influence in that area?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to hang out with Brian Mattson last night, and he reminded me of an important point. And it's this, everyone has a worldview. There's no such thing as a worldviewless ideology. Rick Warren, before the election, told his congregation to vote their values because the other side was voting theirs. We all have values and worldviews that we bring to the public square. And I think that we need to make that point and let people know that our worldview and our values deserve to be a part of the public square as much as anyone else's. This is a fundamental point about religious freedom in America. It's no coincidence that the right to religious freedom is the first clause in the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights, because it's the most important one. And it's directly related to this conversation. Our perspective, our worldview has to be part of the public square. It has to be. Now, as I talked about, there's ways to do it from a theological point of view, and there's ways to do it from more of a natural law point of view. We should be doing all of it in the pluralistic public square.
Eric, I'd hate to see you go without sharing more about the Manhattan Declaration. How can we, in the place that God has put each of us, get to know more about the Declaration? Mm-hmm. How can we use it? Maybe on the side, tell me as a pastor what you envision for churches with respect to the Declaration.
Thank you for that. The Manhattan Declaration. So I'm the first and only full-time employee. It started in 2009, ramped up very quickly. Chuck Colson knew everybody and was able to enlist an astounding group of pastors and other religious leaders to sign that thing. About 425,000 people signed it in the first 3 months. Then we launched an app on the iTunes store, and then it got pulled down. And that caused an uproar, and we got about 25,000 signatures as a result of that. All press is good press, right? But in the time since, in about 2 years between that date and the day that I was hired, they only got another 75,000 signatures or so. So it really kind of tailed off. I was hired specifically to make sure that it didn't go away. Chuck knew that they needed a regular full-time person devoted to making sure the Manhattan Declaration was here to stay. There are all kinds of declarations that have been made, some of them really good, some of them not, and many of them have fallen by the wayside after making a blip. And Chuck understood. He saw where culture was going, and he was right. I mean, I was hired in March of 2012. Think about what's happened since March of 2012 on these three issues. The president came out for gay marriage, the first president ever to do that in May. We had the HHS mandate related to contraception. That was in February, I think, or maybe April of 2012. These issues are at the forefront of the national conversation. Chuck died a week before I started. He hired me. I think he had the intention of coaching me, helping me, teaching me what to do. God had other plans. He called him home. And I only got to meet him once. We talked on the phone once, and I met him once. And that was incredible for me. I mean, I'm someone who was raised by guys like Chuck Colson and James Dobson. And to meet him, even just the one time, was astounding. And for him to go away and to be left with this legacy project of his is... It's an astounding feeling, and leaves me with a sense of real responsibility. I mean, this is Chuck Colson. This is someone who dedicated every moment of his adult life to worldview and to Christ. And And it's my responsibility to make sure that this thing doesn't go away. And so I'm going to pass that responsibility on to all of you because I need your help. I can't do this alone. That's the first thing I recognized. And so I rely on the support of people like you to read the declaration, understand it, utilize the resources that we provide so that you can better understand it and share it with your friends and family. On our Facebook and Twitter feeds, you get daily updates on the latest news and arguments and events and great videos and great infographics that make all of these points that you can share with your family and friends. Every 2 weeks, I send an email. Look, I live in Washington, D.C., and it's a terrible place to live. Honestly, you all are very lucky that you don't live there. And not just because of the housing prices, although I was surprised at how expensive it is to live here. That's really weird. You are just swimming in policy all day, every day in D.C. But I recognize that you all you're not doing that. You all have family. You have real lives. You do important things like work. And no one does that in D.C. So you don't have time. You don't have time to keep up with the latest developments on state marriage law. And you don't have time to read the latest and greatest article by Robert George. My hope is that every 2 weeks I can send you an email with five links. That's it, five links with the greatest stuff that you should take a look at when you have time so that you're kind of up to date and informed on what's going on. That's one very simple thing that I can do to serve you so that you can go and be an influencer. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that we take donations.
One comment, and then we have a question over here. Thank you for waiting. Some of my friends who aren't here because of disagreements, if you read carefully, they say carefully in the beginning of the Manhattan Declaration, this you aren't joining something. You're saying with people that you disagree with theologically about some things, that we have some common goals that we can work for, as you said earlier. Right. Thank you for waiting.
I was fortunate enough to come across the Manhattan Declaration when it first came out on the internet, and I read it, I understood it, and it rang true. And I took it to the other leaders in my church, and we read it together, and we said, why don't we look at our statement of beliefs, which most churches have. You have them on the internet. Well, what we did with ours is we just said, and we further believe, and took a lot of language out of the Manhattan Declaration. So we can. That's another way that we can use it, is to put it out front of our churches.
That's excellent. Thank you for telling me that.
So I think a few of us, I mean, I'm sure a lot of us from time to time have been in conversations with people with whom we disagree, or we have an opportunity to speak in the workplace or at a family gathering or something like that. One of the difficult things, I think, for us as Christians is how to state our case in a winsome and polite way and not an angry way, a way that alienates or scares people away. I was wondering if you could speak to that, maybe in some of the experience that you've had, or Jeff and his experience in speaking with hostile audiences also. I would just appreciate some pointers there.
Yeah, that's really hard. As Dick mentioned, my father-in-law is Sam Brownback. He's the governor of Kansas and was a U.S. senator for a long time, and from Kansas. And in the U.S. Senate, Sam was known as the guy who cared about social justice. He was on the leading edge of Rwanda and the genocide there, and doing something about it and some of the healing in the time afterwards. He's been all over the world in his official capacity and done all kinds of wonderful things related to human sex trafficking and poverty and on and on and on. Nevertheless, he has a reputation as someone who hates gay people. If you knew Sam the way I do, you would know he doesn't hate anyone. He's never hurt a fly. He's the sweetest, most Christ-centered man, one of them certainly, that I've ever met. And yet, I've been at events. I was at one at AEI where I invited him to speak, where a student stood up and essentially blamed his view of homosexuality for teen suicide. That gay teens commit suicide at a high rate, and it's because of people like Sam. I don't know what you can say. You can't say anything to change someone's mind if that's what they believe. Sam demonstrates that no matter how winsome you are, no matter how loving you are, some people are just not able to see through it. That doesn't mean don't be winsome and loving. Absolutely, we have to be. We're called to be. That's our witness. We're called to be ambassadors of Christ. And he was a loving and kind man. He ate dinner with prostitutes and tax collectors. He obviously was in relationship with them. I don't get the picture when the Bible talks about Jesus doing those kinds of things, that those dinners were tense, right? That he was lecturing them and that everyone left in a huff, very angry. I get the impression that he was sitting back, drinking wine, chatting, in relationship. I don't know. I could be wrong about that, but that's the sense that I get. And so I think there are those who will notice. I've had small victories in my own experience with people who assumed coming in that I was going to be a certain way. Maybe one principle is just to assume that someone's going to assume that you're a hateful bigot and do everything you can to confound that perception. Not everything you can, but within, obviously, fidelity to what we know is true, to try to confound that by being kind and smiling. And it really helps to grant some of the points that they make. It can be extremely helpful just to say, you know, I hear what you're saying, and you're right about that. Try to find one little square inch of ground with commonality. That's a great starting point for further conversation. If you can affirm, even if it's just affirming their concern, I hear you. I know what you're saying. That can be a good place to start. Gosh, I don't know. I deal with this all the time, and I have these memories of notes people have sent me where they say things like, you know, Eric, you're not like what I thought. And I think that's a win. I think that's a win for us. Yeah.
We're going to cut the questions off there. Come back in 10 minutes.